forward to this. I think it's going to be a terrific conversation. This hits straight in the sweet spot of electricity planning, operations management, and climate policy, and the codependence between the two. We have two distinguished participants on our fireside chat panel this morning. I am going to start with by introducing John Godfrey, Special Advisor for Climate Change to the Government of Ontario and the Chair of Ontario's Climate Action Group. John has had an extensive career, an accomplished career, that has been dedicated to public service for over 30 years. He was a Member of Parliament, re-elected four times. He was the Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister. He's been in cabinet as Minister of State, Infrastructure and Communities, just to give you maybe the tip of the iceberg. John Godfrey has been involved in many community and public service organizations, too numerous to go through here. And his background, not only a Bachelor of Arts in Modern History and English Literature, but a couple of degrees from Oxford University in Modern History. And it's our great pleasure to invite you up here onto the stage. John, I want to say here for full disclosure, I think this has been mentioned, but of course I have the privilege of sitting on the Climate Action Group, which you have been chairing for Minister Murray, the Minister of the Environment, and Premier Wynne. And you know, my reflection on seeing how you bring together that very diverse representation of sector players who've got very strong views on traditional and progressive new industry, and coming out with the sort of results that you've managed to bring forward to inform the climate change plan has been truly remarkable. You must get a great deal of satisfaction from that. I hope you do. Now, secondly, it's my pleasure to introduce to the stage Bruce Campbell, who is, of course, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Independent Electricity Systems Operator. Most will know him recently for having integrated the Ontario Power Authority into the IESO, no simple task, I'm sure, and combining that planning responsibility, operations responsibility with procurement. Bruce has been instrumental in participating in Ontario's power system for integration of the Ontario's growing investment in renewable, including wind and solar generation, and it was under his direction that ISO has introduced innovative technologies such as storage into the power system and is actively pursuing more competitive, cost-effective solutions to meet future power needs. I gather you're a reformed lawyer, Bruce?
Unreformed.
Well, we'll have to delve into that during the conversation. And let me share with you, Bruce, would you come to the stage, please? It's been a real honor and a pleasure to deal with you, Bruce. You know, someone who I recognize as being a very forward-looking leader in this space, fair and open-minded, unfailingly so, who embraces change. And, you know, I think appreciates, from an industry perspective, what we're facing. And I think as an industry, we also appreciate how thoughtful and accessible you've personally been in treating with important issues in our industry. So thank you for that. Now, where do we go from here? This is the big question. Just to remind everyone, we're talking here about this codependence, this growing codependence between climate policy and electricity systems operations and planning and procurement. And who better to have on the stage with us than these two individuals? And so I would like to begin, if I might, with John, and perhaps just asking if you would spend a couple of minutes talking about climate change action policy and cap and trade and the work that you've been doing and how Ontario is situated in that front.
Sure. Well, thank you very much, and thank you. It's nice to be sitting on a solar panel.
I don't think I've I don't think I've actually heard that one before.
I couldn't resist. I thought I'd do it before he did. So I came in as a special advisor to the government about a year ago, and the decision to undertake a cap and trade system had already been made. They didn't ask me, and so I've been part of the team which has been trying to figure out how to do it. The thing to be said is that the climate change file really falls into three big chunks. Mitigation, which is what we're talking about today. How do we actually reduce greenhouse gases? Adaptation, which we don't talk nearly enough about in the province, and which will be discussed in a fuller way in the fall when part two of the action plan comes out, which will be about adaptation, and must be because it has huge effects on things like the electricity system. And then the third part, which is what you're all about, which is the economic opportunity of moving to a low carbon economy. And I think that's by far the most exciting part in a way. I mean, we have to do what we have to do for mitigation and adaptation, but the chance to undertake a kind of fourth industrial revolution, which you're part of, strikes me as really exciting. And it also requires a lot of attention because this will be the first industrial revolution which wasn't simply caused by market forces and the development of new technologies, everything from steam engines to the Apple. This will be the first industrial revolution driven by public policy, where we've actually said, we're gonna have to put a price on carbon, we're gonna have to undertake a series of measures to save ourselves. And that's remarkable. There isn't a precedent in human history of doing something like that. And it's a hugely ambitious goal and a hugely necessary goal. And I view these three things as being absolutely integrated. You cannot do one without the other. We cannot spend all of our time mitigating and reducing greenhouse gases and not deal with the reality that's coming at us in the form of climate change already, its impacts, extreme weather events, and global warming. So the challenge is, and I say this as a historian, how do you bring people along with you? If you've been watching the front page of the Globe and Mail yesterday, today, a couple of weeks ago, you can find everything you want about the Climate Action Plan. Not my idea, but anyway. And you'll see the usual suspects. You'll see everybody who has a vested interest in this not succeeding. But there's an overriding factor, which is that we've all got an interest in seeing this to be successful because we won't have a planet unless we're successful. So as a historian, I'm really interested in how populations shift in their behaviors and views of things. And frequently, it's a question of how you present things. When I was Minister of Infrastructure, and I'll stop on this note, we undertook a survey about cities because I was in charge of the New Deal for Cities. And we asked a poll question, which if I'd seen it before, we never would have asked, would you like to live in a more densely populated city? And everybody thought, you know, this is Calcutta. I don't want to live in Calcutta. Had we simply asked, would you like to live in a more walkable city? Same thing, right? Why, that changes everything. And so when, for example, the decision was made to get rid of the coal-fired generating plants, one of the ancillary benefits was cleaner air, fewer smog days. I mean, there were a whole bunch of other things than simply reducing greenhouse gases. And I think we need to get people on board for the exciting part of the story, which is the new industrial revolution, which is what you guys are doing. And so I think we need to overcome natural human fear of change and say, come along on the adventure with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that, John. I'm really struck by this line, the idea that we're going to be going through an industrial revolution and driven by, you know, government policy. And I think you're speaking globally, not just here in
Absolutely.
Ontario.
That's what the Paris Agreement at COP21, 195 countries, is establishing global policy on things like carbon pricing and moving towards a low carbon economy.
Right. Real transformation and, of course, having its influence on, or at least the premise here, is on electricity policy. So Bruce, would you tell us a little bit about your views in terms of how this climate policy developments is impacting the electricity sector in Ontario?
Sure, John. And I'd start by saying the ISO operates within a policy context. And if I read the Globe and Mail this this week, it's that policy context is going to put more burden on us, because the fact is that what you folks deliver in solar energy, you're not actually delivering sunshine. At the end of the day, you're delivering electricity. And that's our bailiwick. So we've got to work within this policy framework with you to make sure that all of this is executed. The policy stuff is great, it's lovely. We have to actually, together, make it work on the ground. And that's going to be a big job, given the kind of ambition that is being shown with the action plan. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Before I do, though, I want to thank Attilia for the opportunity to, in her role as chair, for the opportunity to be here today. I want to let the CANSEA members know that John and I, at least from my perspective, have an excellent working relationship. We don't talk every day, but when we need to pick up the phone, John always answers, and I try to take his calls as well. I think that relationship is great. I loved Wes's talk all about change. We've been going through change. You know, starting into the coal shutdown program has been, our life has been about change. And clearly that's going to continue. Wonderful range of gala winners last night. Congratulations. I was unable to get here for that event, but I gather some great awards. And you couldn't have picked a theme for the conference, Utilia, any more pertinent than the one that you outlined, certainly. And all of the Globe and Mail stuff this week has just reinforced the wisdom of picking that theme. So at the ISO, we're about electricity, we're about conservation, we're about new technologies, and we're about making all of that work together. And I have a few members of our team here today, Viviana von Bertoli sitting over there, Rob Sinclair, Bob Chow, Barb Ellard's supposed to be here later today to talk about the market platform that we'll be developing. So interesting afternoon. Anything that needs correction, they will correct, that I say that needs correction, they will not hesitate to correct me this afternoon. And the other thing I wanted to mention was I really have appreciated CANSEA's contribution to sector discussions. The distributed generation report got mentioned in Wes's talk. I think that's a real contribution to that discussion. And I harked back and took a look before coming today at the Roadmap 2020 that was developed a couple of years ago, I think now, 2 years ago. And theme number 5 in that Roadmap 2020 had to do with, and I think I'm quoting here, a new relationship with other technologies. This isn't just a matter of taking panels and hooking them up. It's about how do we integrate this into the range of technologies that are also available to us. And, you know, I look at John's quote from the Globe this morning. The new plan could accelerate installations in smaller system for houses and industrial buildings. And I think that's absolutely correct, but I'm going to get on a little theme of something that I like to talk about now is, don't look at this just as solar panels feeding the system. It is time to forge much stronger and new relationships with other technologies. And the one I particularly have my eye on is a combination of storage and some of the technologies that allow all of this to be integrated in, particularly at the distribution system level. I see Panasonic as a presenting partner for the conference, and I thought it was really great. You've got all this solar sign on the front of your pamphlet, and on the back is the advertisement for Panasonic's batteries. And I think that's a combination that we need to look hard at going forward. And I think Wes also talked about changing business models. And I think the as solar has become more economic and as it gets paired up with storage, it is clear that that is going to change business models dramatically. And I'll give you two examples. I went up about 5 weeks ago. There must be some people from PowerStream here. PowerStream people?
Yep,
there we go.
At the back there.
I went up about 5 or 6 weeks ago to with Brian Benz to a opening of what they call the virtual power plant. 20 houses, all equipped with batteries, solar panels on the roof, ability to connect in the battery from the car for cars for charging, all of that. And I expected this to be something that they were doing 20 times over, 20 individual units. But they were doing something much more sophisticated than that. What they're doing is they've got software that centrally, at the PowerStream operations room, they can look at all of those 20 houses and treat them in an aggregated way as a little power unit. All producing solar, all interconnected, a little more power here, drawing from one side of the 20 and putting it into the other, and vice versa. I looked at that and I was stunned. I'm looking at that and I'm saying, that's 20 houses. When there's 20,000 of them, or 200,000 of them, hooked together, SunVerge software, when that's all hooked together, all of a sudden, there within PowerStream, I have the equivalent of a nuclear unit. That's where this can go. And not only can it do that on a system control basis, it will fundamentally change our relationship operating with local distribution companies that take advantage of these opportunities for their customers. Not only will it do that, but it can be done on a very commercial basis. In February, in Park Slope, New York, a group, similar-sized group of individuals, solar, battery, et cetera, started doing transactions between themselves. The term we use in talking about this one we're feeling particularly Boffin-like is transactive energy. But it means that John and I do a transaction with no intermediary. We don't need to do this through the LDC. John's injecting, I'm withdrawing. The software just manages that transaction. And to show you just how completely far I am out of my depth and how this is done, This is using a technology called blockchains, which is the same technology that is used for Bitcoin transactions, encrypted, information-rich blockchains that would manage this whole transaction. And for the first time, that technology is being deployed in a very small way, but in a very beginning way, in a big urban environment. So I look at all of this and I say, that's what you need to think about your business models. I urge you not simply to think of it as a solar installation feeding a grid. I think your opportunities are much greater than that, much more interesting, much more revolutionary in terms of their impact on the system. And certainly, it will fundamentally change our relationship with the local distribution companies, and it'll fundamentally change the whole customer relationships that you have with your customers. So exciting times, wonderful technologies being developed, but don't just think about your panels.
Thank you for that, Bruce. I'm, you know, being up here and speaking about it like this with the two of you, has, you know, got me almost ready to jump up. And you know, we've had a couple of you know, offline conversations in various times. John, you and I talking about this convergence of technologies and the way that policy is driving that. This climate change policy, in a way, is bringing together a number of programs that have already been initiated. And we talk about you know, this scenario that Bruce has outlined not being the future. I mean, it's here. We've got a smart meter on every single home and business. We've got a terrific, strong program for having panels on the house. We're doing storage now through the ISO. You can see the battery in the basement, the EV in the driveway with the rebates from the program, software that's helping control how people generate and manage and arbitrage and trade electricity, all, you know, being driven by policy and programming and implementation and delivery. Very, very exciting. Let me ask you, John, when you embarked on this mandate to outline the Climate Change Action Plan, you were working with an electricity system that is 90% fossil fuel free here in Ontario. How did that influence our options, your approach?
Well, I think it's crucial, and I go back to a report that was written by McKinsey, their global office, a number of years ago, which said the answer to climate change is really simple. There are three things you need to do: efficiency, electricity, and trees. And there's a tremendous truth in that. The thing that hit me when I came into it as an outsider, really, a year ago. I mean, I'd had experience as a minister having to deal with adaptation. When you're the infrastructure minister, you think about these things. But I had a kind of epiphany when I realized that the key to everything is electricity. It is the connection between the solutions and the problems. It's fungible. It's like money. It's a medium of exchange for solutions. And so that's when I started trying to understand the Ontario electricity system, and I quickly discovered that the brains of the operation really is with these guys, ISO and their former partner, OPA now, which has been integrated. And that these are remarkable conversations. I mean, it gets right down to the most trivial kind of decision. I went out to buy a lawnmower on Sunday. I really tried to be crunchy granola and do a push mower. You know, push mowers don't work. I mean, that's, you know, the little hand thing, it doesn't work. I had the guy with the bell who sharpens things, I had him sharpen it, still didn't work. So I'm faced with the choice, and of course, it's a no-brainer. You go for the electric lawnmower, which is 97% carbon-free, right? I mean, and you do it with good heart. You feel, well, it's okay. The most remarkable thing that's happened in Ontario that I don't think we give credit to the electricity folks for is the extraordinary transformation since 2005. I mean, a system which was really being run down. We had brownouts. We had all sorts of dreadful things go on. And now we've got a bright and shiny electricity system. It costs more because it should have cost more way back in the day. We should have been renewing the nuclear and doing all of that stuff before. And on top of that, we get rid of coal, which was a very cheap way of generating stuff. But the payoff down the road is remarkable because we now can, with good heart, do those fuel switching things, which would not make any sense if you were still using coal to produce the electricity. And so one of the things that our committee has looked at, and which is obvious and is in the action plan, as described by the Globe and Mail, but not by me, is the big push on the electrification of vehicles. There are really two big problems in Ontario in terms of emissions. The two areas where emissions have continued to grow are in transportation and in heating our homes. We heat our homes with natural gas to 90% or something like that, and we've got to do something about that. But it's the transportation sector which is really killing us. Ontarians love their cars. We've created a landform use which virtually dictates that if you're living in the suburbs with grown children, you got to have three or four cars. I mean, it's just, we did that to ourselves when we started developing the suburbs after the Second World War. We're not going to undo it uniquely through public transit. There just isn't enough public, it just doesn't make any sense. The densities aren't there. So we need to do the fuel switch to electricity for sure. And it's very interesting that on our committee sits a brilliant woman who works out of McMaster called Josipa Petrunic. And she's working with the electricity folk on the very question of, well, what if it's a success? Like, what kind of a load is that going to put on the system? And then how can we counteract that by charging in the middle of the night when the nukes are running full tilt and hydro can... How do we do all that stuff? So it's the planning for success that's going to be really challenging for IESO right now. And you know, we're at... Right now, there's, I guess, an installed capacity of whatever, 37,000 or something to that. We're using today probably 15,000, something like that. So it sounds good. We got to plan for the peaks, we got to plan for outages, but we've got to be able to figure out how to incorporate all of these technologies in a way that will allow us to do the switch, which will bring down emissions.
So let me pick it up right there. That's a perfect transition, and talking about electrification and the planning that's involved there, and Bruce, to use John's qualification of you as the brains of the operation.
No one in the company would agree with that characteristic.
No pressure.
As the brains of the operation, as we go through this, you know, deep electrification, do you have the tools that you need? Are we going to be able to accommodate these electric vehicles and the other demands that are going to come on the sort of transformation that John has outlined?
For the time being, yes. But I think it really depends longer term on our ability to take our renewable technologies and extract the most value from them. And I think that's where, I mean, you're going to hear a theme here. That's where I start to drive back towards storage. We have lots of time right now where we have surplus baseload generation that is either exported or we have to back off both wind units and our nuclear units. That's part of our daily operating environment now. So that there is some cushion there that can absorb increased electricity use. I actually think that going forward, though, if there is going to be the level of electrification that is consistent with some of the, if you read all of the things in the Globe and Mail as all happening over a short time frame, will be pressed. But, you know, that's what kind of makes life exciting. We do have, you know, we've got a lot of wind on the system by 2025. Even on our current estimates, we're looking at about 3,500 megawatts of solar. So with a solid program on the energy efficiency side, which I believe we're well launched on, and with net of that, we already see the load as being relatively flat pretty much over the whole planning period that we're looking at. And we are looking at some scenarios that would say, here's what's needed under various degrees of aggressive use of electricity to address carbon issues. So, you know, stay tuned on that. We have a planning report that is contemplated under the new legislation, the Bill 135 for the long-term energy plan. We have a planning report that we anticipate if that bill passes, we would be looking at getting it out the door early summer. And it does look at all of these different alternatives just sort of in the factual background. And then there will have to be a policy discussion that I think starts to bring together, not into the long-term energy plan, the potential impact of the climate change steps that are being taken. And I think there'll be a wonderful debate about the degree to which we've been able to capture all of that. But I think that's a very good debate to have. We have time now on our side. We have some capability to absorb a range of load growth. And while we're doing that, to assess what climate change actions are producing and looking at the kinds of measures that we would need to take to keep up with that if we're at the, you know, the high end of the aggressive scale on all of this, which we appear to be at have every intention of doing. So I mean, I'm a glass half full guy. So I look at this room, I look at the equivalent room at CanSEA, I look at the Ontario Water Power Association, and I look at the confidence that we have in the nuclear refurbishments, which will be a solid base to work on. And as I say, so I'm pretty optimistic, but we need to keep our eye on this starting right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something we can sort of say, well, let's keep busy on what we've got on our plate now. We are going to have to take a look at all of this in a very careful way, and take actions, sometimes given our planning time frames, sometimes a little in advance of the need. But I'd rather have a little bit too much than a little bit not enough.
Well, you know, that's very reassuring to hear you say that, Bruce. I know that the changes are big, but I think I'm speaking for our industry and the rest of the stakeholders in this electricity sector in acknowledging the terrific job, very complicated job that ISO has performed to date in terms of phasing out coal and bringing in these multiple sources of electricity and balancing them and looking forward to what we can do. I'm going to keep you on the spot for a moment before going back to John, and we're going to go to the audience for some questions, so we'll move along here. But while I had you on stage here, I want to bring up the MicroFIT program. The program itself, of course, has been suspended, a very serious issue, not just for our industry and the players involved, but arguably, it's the touch point for residents and small businesses who are adopting solar, and there's many reasons to need this window opened as quickly as possible. And I think you've communicated very forcefully. We've been engaged as an industry discussing some of the consumer protection related issues that are associated with this. From CanSEA's perspective, of course, and I think credit to the very open door that you have, Bruce, CanSEA has been accelerating the work that it's doing around consumer protection issues raised by the ISO. We've initiated the Consumer Protection Forum that we started in February 2016. We've accelerated that to implement changes to the CanSEA policy. We've developed public-facing materials. We are revamping our code of conduct to reflect some of these consumer protection issues, and you have that in front of yourself and your staff now. I know we're interfacing. We're consulting with members broadly on these issues. So, responding, how is ISO viewing this issue now, and what do we have to look forward over the coming weeks?
So let me just back up and say this was not a step that we took lightly. It is a suspension. It is not a closure of the program. It is a suspension while allowing both of us, frankly, John, to become confident that some of the issues that have been raised in terms of market behavior require some consumer protection oversight. I must say, as we started to get into this, and as it started to hit my desk, I was quite surprised to learn that none of the kind of normal consumer protection the regulatory mechanisms that are available, seem to be available to deal with these kinds of issues. I'm not going to go through the details of the issues. They're basically pretty, in many ways, kind of consumer protection issues that we've seen in some other areas. For instance, the OEB has a whole process around sales of other kinds of electricity contracts. But none of that actually seems to apply to the operations of the MicroFIT programs. And I confess that was a bit of a surprise to me, and certainly a regulatory gap. And as we heard of this, more and more of this, because we're sponsors of the program and fund it, we just got to a point where, as you and I discussed, we need it. There needed to be a strong consumer protection framework put in place. And, you know, I'm very encouraged by the code of conduct. We're looking at some of the compliance things. We'll be giving you some comments back on that later this week. I think you've asked for a 19th deadline for the 19th. And we'll be working with you to assess, are we in a position that can we that we can open the applications? I mean, the business is it has a couple of different sides. Obviously, there are people going out speaking to homeowners and making their contractual arrangements with homeowners, and it's only really subsequent to that that the applications come into the IESO. So I think we're in the position that we'll want to be sure before we announce a date for starting to accept applications again that there is the kind of protection in that I can go to my board and say, you know, we talked to you about the kinds of problems we were seeing and the kind of step we felt we had to take. I certainly had full support from my board, and now I'll have to go back to them and say, here's the situation, explain what the measures that have been put in place, and say, therefore, I've taken a decision to kind of to reopen that. I think the timing is tough. We're going to be looking at what is actually up and running at CANSEA to help manage this program that consumers can be referred to. If we're very close to the time, like we're working hard on the IT because, as you know, the program is being revamped slightly. That was originally scheduled for the beginning of July. We're working hard on the IT. IT problems are always intractable. But there will be some period where, as we get closer to that date, and we keep trying to advance that date, but where we get close to that date where we'll say, you know, for several weeks, it's not worth it to go accepting old, now accepting new, and we'll move on to the new one. I understand fully and appreciate fully the desire to get the application process going again, but we want to do it in a way that is sustainable and is fully backed up by the CANSEA process. And I have to compliment you for kind of taking this on. I think it's a great role for the association, and it gives, particularly in a world where we see a very expanding market for this, and I'm enthusiastic, you know, this stuff of the virtual power plant, all of that, I get really excited about all that stuff. That's the world that we should be heading to, but we've got to do it within an appropriate framework, and that's where we're headed.
Thank you for that, Bruce, and you can count on us to continue to be responsive and be chasing these things down. I appreciate very much, I'm sure we all do, that we have the ISO's understanding of this issue and is working actively to address it. So thanks for that. We also, of course, have the session coming up later today that is going to look pretty specifically at this issue, and all of our members will be able to get into depth. Now,
I thought I'd just let Rob off the hook completely for the afternoon. But
he'll be there to take he'll be there to take the tough questions. So I've got one more issue here. This one's for John, and then we'll have time for a couple of questions from the floor. And I'm sure many of you have got some very interesting issues that you'd like to bring up. So John, this is an issue we've discussed before. Many progressive programs have been launched. They're being brought together to a certain extent by this Climate Change Action Plan. And arguably, Ontario is a low carbon economy leader from the perspective of the type of progressive policies we have here. But until this point, there's been little connection, I would say, between all of those programs. Where's the unifying vision? And maybe we'll get that now with the Climate Change Action Plan, but you get to a second part, which has to do, how are we going to coordinate all of these things and bring it together? It's because this plan is looking at things from a comprehensive perspective. It's not just electricity, it's not just gas, it's many things. So have you, in your musings about what sort of coordination is going to be needed here, LDCs, planning agencies, utilities, et cetera, is an agency, a low-carbon agency, the answer? Is there some What is it that's going to be the thing that makes all of this gel?
Well, it's a really great question, because one of the things that characterizes, I would say, all three pillars of climate change policy is that each of them, mitigation, adaptation, economic opportunity, would fall into a category which you would call whole of government or boundary spanning. Traditionally, governments are set up to have line departments with ministerial responsibility for a narrow sector, we'll say energy or environment. But these problems can only be solved by interconnection and by people behaving in a coordinated and integrated way. And so at each of these pillars, so to speak, we need to be able to figure out strategies, first of all, for the government to get its own house in order. Because if you think about it, the number of ministries that are affected by mitigation issues is considerable. And yet there's not any central coordination of that, and indeed the ability to I don't want to use the word force ministries to talk to each other and to coordinate. We now have, on the mitigation side, in the Department of the Environment, the Climate Change Secretariat. And at least that place is where we can keep score of how all of these things add up, how what we're doing in the building sector or the town planning sector or the infrastructure sector or the transportation sector, how are we doing? And where can we find synergies between the various departments? But those synergies are not limited to simply government action. I mean, that's the start. They set the policy framework. They create the incentives. They have procurement. The governments have a huge amount of authority. So the first responsibility of a government on each of these three files is to get its house in order and to have a whole of government strategy. And this does not come naturally. For example, when, and this happened both at the provincial level here in Ontario and the federal level. The traditional ministries were the Ministry of the Environment. And so people said, oh, let's just add the words and climate change to both the province and the feds, as if somehow that was a rhetorical solution that would do it for you. Well, of course, it won't do it for you. It just simply creates frustration on the part of the ministers who are still line ministers. They, you know, as three-year-olds would say, you are not the boss of me. And so it is with other departments. So the first order of business is for governments to mobilize their own resources. By the way, they also have to deal with other governments. We, to get our policies right, need to coordinate with the feds, who need to get their house in order too. And sometimes we need to coordinate, and frequently actually, with the municipalities, because they're big players in all of this. So that's the first part. But we then need to find ways of reaching out to all of the quasi-governmental units, ISO and agencies and all the rest of it, to make sure that all of that lines up, and work with the private sector so that we all know what we're doing. There are two things that are really important that we aren't so good at and haven't been historically. One is a longer term view of things. We're heading now for targets like 2020, 2030 for emission reductions, 2050, very ambitious. And the only way you can get there is to take it in 5-year increments. I mean, the action plan, which is all over the Globe and Mail, is for a 5-year period. And so that's important. You need to be consistent. Business needs to know what the price signal is, that Absolutely. You don't mess around with it, and because there's a change of government, you reverse it all. If you want to see how not to do climate policy, well, you could look for the last 10 years in Ottawa, but never mind. That's it. You could look to Australia, where they just keep jerking everything around. Like, they start off in one thing, and then they pull it back, and they elect Tony Abbott, who's a jerk, and then they now elect Turnbull, who's not such a jerk. I mean, but politicians can really mess this up. And I'm allowed to say that because I'm a recovering politician. My name is John. So that's one thing. You need, and the trouble is that our horizons in both business and politics can be very short-term. And the horizon of the consumer and the citizen are short-term. We're in a long-term war here, which requires the total mobilization of society. If we don't get this right, we're dead. So that requires patience and a time frame we're not used to dealing with. So that's hugely important, and we need to be consistent And it needs to become what they would say in Quebec is a projet de société, a societal project, a national project. This thing needs to be beyond partisanship. So we need to recruit Andrea Horvath and Patrick Brown to the cause and say, whoever is in charge here, it's like the healthcare system. You meddle with it at your peril. We need to make that a societal consensus and not be jerked around by elections and short-term considerations and popularity and polls and all that stuff. And this is where I really give credit to the premier. She's playing the long game, even if it's dangerous politically in the short term.
Thank you for that. And solar is going to be there as part of this equation, delivering on this. Listen, I would love to stand up here and continue this conversation. I could do this for hours. I'm conscious of our time here, and I know we've got some tight schedules here. John, you've got to get back to Toronto. Let's just have a couple of questions, if we could. And if you've got a question, this is the first panel. I don't know if we have a. Oh, we do have a microphone. There we go.
Yeah, there's one over there too.
Is that Fidel?
No.
Fidel.
How you doing? In an overly simplistic way, but since we have the beauty of actually establishing this industrial revolution through policy, we have a fairly neutral stance on electricity requirement and electricity load issues going forward. So, we're sort of in this skating forward mode. We've got some big things like refurbishments and other things, and obviously we've talked about electrification. How far are we away from being able to create a policy statement that effectively says net new loads on the electricity sector as a result of electrification for the purposes of reducing carbon will be supported by 100% renewables?
Who wants to take that one?
Bruce.
I learned during the blackout in 2003, when people would consistently ask me, what steps can you take to ensure that this will never happen again? I never say never. So I will say that I think that if we can keep the cost curve in the direction it's going on renewables, that we, together with serious efficiency efforts. I mean, we operate or manage currently a 2.2 billion five-year conservation first program with the local distribution companies. And we're pretty hopeful that that can meet our targets. That will keep load flat. And there seems to be lots of capability around the renewables, and I think that all of you folks who've rushed off to Alberta should read the Globe and Mail this morning or this week and start thinking about Ontario all over again in a different way, because I think there will be much more reliance on renewables, all of this. There's no, at some point, may we have to add back in some technologies to give us some characteristics that we need that we otherwise wouldn't do? Maybe, but in this environment, we'll be looking for planning options that are as carbon-free as we can possibly make them. That's just going to be the atmosphere we're operating in. And, I've got Bob Chow here on the transmission side. We have some pretty smart planners. And we've gone through an incredible amount of change. I mean, we've taken coal out of the system with a stored fuel. You need more power, you throw in some more coal. That's the kind of world that 20 years ago, how we operated the power system. With the amount of wind and solar that has come into the system, our folks have learned not to be afraid of this, what its capabilities are, how to take advantage of those capabilities. I'm not so sure on the solar side, but the wind has turned out to be incredibly flexible. It's a great resource. So I've got 100 megawatts wind farm with the wind sufficient to churn out the whole 100 megawatts, we can tell that farm, okay, we'd like you to operate at 80 for energy purposes and 20 for operating reserve purposes. So if we have a problem on the system and we have to crank up some generation, we can do it with the wind. Very fast acting, et cetera, et cetera. Storage mixed with solar would give us the same kind of capabilities. So we spend a lot of time learning about the capabilities and the ways to better use these carbon-free technologies, and I think we'll just continue to do that. I will never, I've been too long associated with electricity planning to say we'll never use that technology ever again. I think it's fair to say we can say that about coal.
John, do you have something to add to that?
The only thing I want to add is that while it's important to have the long-range view and the five-year view, and the very when you're refurbishing a nuclear unit, that's a long-term commitment. That's
absolutely
not, you've got to amortize that. And we've had this conversation, Bruce and I. The real challenge is to try and figure out what the disruptive technologies are going to be. I mean, you guys are a disruptive technology, and with the right combination of other technologies like storage and microgrids and all the rest of it, you're going to be more disruptive. And the challenge for Bruce is how do you anticipate that? How do you build it in? How are you not so locked into your plans that you can't take advantage of this? Because if you don't take advantage of it, it's going to take advantage of you. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I can tell you one of the strategic objectives I just had approved by at our board level is to find a few LDCs that we can try some of this stuff out with. Because if all of you folks do what I described and have all of this action happening on a distributed generation scale, it fundamentally changes the relationship that we have with the LDCs. It fundamentally changes what our business model is going to look like. It's not just a matter of these kinds of technologies adding to your business models with wonderful opportunities, but it fundamentally changes our business model. And so we're already starting to look at what's the kind of relationship we have with local distribution companies. How do we deal with this when I want to be able to go to PowerStream and say, look, I need reactive power support for the power system. Can you sell me that? It's not just a one-way street anymore. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a very integrated, networked world. And that's what we're starting to get ready for. And my big problem as we discuss around the company, the strategic plan for the company is, when do I place the bet and make really big investments in all of this? And, you know, as we've gone through this week, you know, my thinking is starting to change. It's maybe not so far away as I thought it might have been. But that's the tough thing from a strategic point of view for us, is when do we put our money down, your money down, the ratepayers' money down, on making and learning the fundamental transitions that we know we're going to face sooner or later.
This is just fascinating. I'm going to say I don't know that we'll get to two more questions. We will get to one more question at least here. I'm used to Patrick Bateman, who's of course designs our programs, telling me to booting me off the stage for going too long. But let's take this one question over here, and we'll see if we can get to another one.
That's a perfect segue to what I wanted to ask. I had a question for John Gorman. Key to all of this and unlocking opportunities for everyone in this room for that private capital leverage is getting the municipalities and the LDCs to roll out some enabling programs, to drop a few dollars in a few programs and a few ideas to actually get these technologies onto houses, onto small businesses. So I'm wondering where the province's heads at with that right now and how quickly they can kind of get the municipalities and the LDCs up to speed and empower them a bit.
Well, I'm wondering if this is a regional planning question almost, or, you know, that there will be some interface there. But John, would you take a...
Well, I think basically the province rightly outsources its major deep thinking about this to outfits like IESO. That's because the system is so complex with all of these components that it would be amateur night at the Roxy if governments, the generalists of governments, tried to sort out that question. What I think you do when you're not an expert is you trust people who are experts. You give, they're your proxies. You say to them, you say to Bruce, look, you tell us what do you need from us in terms of changing the rules and regs or encouraging people to behave differently, and explain it to us why that would make sense, and then we will back you up. I think that is the role of government. It's not to second guess the people you put in charge of the system. But it is just to make sure that you've thought of everything, and that we thought of it from a kind of electors or citizen or consumer point of view. But at the end of the day, that is a discussion that governments continue, the Ministry of Energy has to have continually with IESO.
And we do.
Yeah.
And we do. And there will be an exercise later this year with the refresh of the long-term energy plan where these questions will be squarely on the table. Let me just start, mention just because, John, I do want to pick up on the regional planning point, and Bob Chow will be talking about this later this afternoon. But I think, in answer to the question that was asked here, that the regional planning work that we're undertaking, which is to take what electricity planning is sort of at a provincial level and break it down and say, look, the technologies now give us choices at a local level that we never had before, and we need to engage, instead of having electricity be something completely independent of municipal planning, which has been a terrible situation for how long, ever long, instead of having it being completely separate from municipal planning, what we're trying to do is say, in our regional planning, we need to do land use planning and energy planning at the same time in an integrated way. And we're just taking some baby steps on that. In some cases, solutions need to be found and put in, wire solutions need to be put in place because that's the only thing that can deal with the precise problem we have today. But where we're trying to go is to make sure that every single land use planning exercise incorporates energy into that, and that's something in our regional planning that's where the target is. And Bob will be talking this afternoon and talking to some of the bumps along that particular road that we've seen, but that's certainly what our objective is.
Okay, final question, and we'll forego the closing remarks. It's up
to
you.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to congratulate John and the Ontario government for this climate action plan. I think it's fantastic that such a comprehensive strategy is being looked at. I have a question, and we know that the Paris targets are unacceptably high. It's been estimated it'll result in temperatures between 2.7 and 3.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels, which is catastrophic, and recent papers have shown that 2 degrees is going to be highly dangerous, Hansen's recent paper. So my question is, what are the targets that the Ontario government is looking at in terms of achieving, given that, well, we know Canada's commitment is insufficient, we know the international commitments are insufficient?
Well, the technical answer to that is that the target, and always we measure from the 1990 baseline. Our previous target was for 2014 was -6, and we got to there thanks to the coal-fired plants being taken offline. That was expensive, but relatively low-hanging fruit.
Don't tell my operators that.
No, I mean, but now the work begins, because the next target is -15% for 2020, -37.5%, don't ask why, for 2030, and -80% for 2050. So those are the official targets, and when we create an action plan in 5-year increments, it is assumed that we've got to be on the right trajectory, okay? But to your point, the good news about Paris was that we got 195 countries to agree that climate change was real, that it was man-made or human-made, and that we needed to do something about it. The early targets are not nearly aggressive enough, but the fact that there are targets by so many countries is a great start. And the pressure is now on the system, because it was said at Paris, you're right, it can't be a 2% global warming target is not sufficient, because that 2% is a global average. The oceans don't go at that speed, but the land masses go above that to average out, and it's worse in the north, right? Where the permafrost is and where the boreal forest is. There's a number of nightmare scenarios there. So from my point of view, just looking at it as a historian and as a politician, I would say the main thing is you gotta get the stake in the ground, and then you gotta keep moving the targets up. It is an iterative process, and it is one of peer pressure, frankly, And I think that there's a right pace for the province to be leaders on this. If you're too far out, you know, things are too expensive, you're not competitive. If you're just cresting that wave in things like clean technologies and solar and all the rest of it, there's a sweet spot there. And we've got to figure what that is. And we've got this huge resource. I mean, the fact that we cleaned up our Electricity Act puts us way ahead of the American states who are now dealing with the Green Power Act of Obama and all the rest of it. We're there, and we can't coast. We absolutely can't coast. We've got to be best of breed. And we go back to a tradition, and I'm of Ontario Hydro, which has been a leader, right? You know, from the days of Adam Beck through nuclear power and all the rest of it. We need to recover that spot and be known for that, because that's what we used to do. We used to export our expertise to Barcelona and to Brazil and all the rest of it. And we need to be in that space in the clean tech world. And one of the components of the action plan is intended to deal with some of the financing issues with that. Stay tuned. It wasn't all together in the Globe and Mail.
And one of the reasons I have confidence in all of this, I mean, it's going to be a lot of work. One of the reasons I have confidence is because we've shown our capability to change. When we've integrated solar and wind into the system, we quietly give advice to California. I don't suppose everybody would think it goes the other way. When it comes to the standards for connection and so on, some of the technical stuff, we're doing exactly what John's talking about. We actually are a go-to source of information as to how to address some of the issues associated with operating a high proportion of variable resources on the system. So I love John's characterization of this. As far as I'm concerned, what outcome do you want? Tell us the outcome you want. Cut us loose, because we'll find a good way to get there.
What a great way and point to end on. Perfect note. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Interesting, engaging, so informative for all of us. Can we have a round of applause for John and Bruce?